If you watched the Netflix documentary, The Great Hack, you will remember Brittany Kaiser. She was a Democrat. She had a history of working for progressive political campaigns, including Obama's campaign. She was human rights organizations. Yet she became a director of Cambridge Analytica, the UK-based company accused of handling stolen Facebook data to influence the Trump election, the Brexit referendum, and other campaigns. The company collapsed in disgrace last year. Kaiser had become a whistleblower, and now she's written a book called Targeted, My Inside Story of Cambridge Analytica and How Trump, Brexit, and Facebook Broke Democracy. She is now co-founder of the Digital Asset Trade Association, or DATA, aiming to protect privacy and ensure that people have control over their own data. So I asked her at what point she realized that she was working for a company that was psychologically profiling voters by illegally accessing and analyzing their private information and then targeting them to influence political behavior.
Some of it, actually, I found out from the press, because a lot of the data management that I was involved with while I was at the company was helping negotiate deals to purchase data legally from what they call big data aggregators. So companies like Experian and Infogroup, Axiom, Magellan, these are companies that individuals don't really realize are collecting data all around the world about everything we do every day. And they're selling it not just to the highest bidder, but anybody that decides that they want access. You don't have to be from that country to access data on certain citizens. And there is little regulation about how that's traded. And once I started to see what that looked like, and how untransparent it was, and how coercive it is, I started to think there's got to be a better way.
How did it work?
So the way that data modeling works, whether you're doing psychological profiling, or you're trying to figure out how likely someone is to vote, or how likely they are to buy a new brand of toothpaste or car, it starts with being able to purchase the private information. Well, I wish it was private. The personal information of individuals. So that'll be everything from your credit card swipes to your location data to where you go on vacation and what you like to read. Once you have enough of this data, you're able to undertake a little bit of research, market research or political polling, and apply that to a model, and then give a score to everybody in your database of how likely they are to take a certain action. That allows you to put every single person into different audience groups, whether big or small. And every single audience, every group of people, is going to get a completely different message than the next group.
Because you're targeting, to suit their psychological profile, you're targeting their particular personality.
Absolutely. And it doesn't just have to be personality, but what actions they're likely to take. So, for instance, if they're very likely to vote, or they're very likely to care about a particular issue, healthcare or education. But it means that your reality on social media is completely different to mine. And that's where the problems begin.
And you find out who the persuadables are.
Yes. So everybody is a little bit persuadable, but there are some people that are a lot more than others. And there's different levels of persuadability depending on what it is. I might be more likely to be persuaded to take action on a political issue. Someone else might be more likely to be easily convinced to make a snap purchase without thinking about it. So data scientists can use all of our personal information to figure out who's the most persuadable in which instance and spend the entire marketing budget talking to just those people.
When the first story started to appear about Cambridge Analytica using Facebook data obtained non-consensually, what did you think?
I was actually very surprised, because I was always told by my executives that the data that we collected from Facebook was collected not only consensually and completely legally, but collected in ways that we were not the only people doing this. Everyone in the industry was. And I had it even in my presentations to clients that Facebook data was part of our database. So I was quite shocked to find out that this was either taken in a coercive manner or perhaps even in a legal manner.
Well, illegal in that not only did you get the people who filled out the questionnaire, but you got all their friends. That's how Cambridge Analytica acquired something like 87 million data profiles, correct?
Absolutely. And there's two different concerns there. One is that potentially the largest data set that was collected was only meant to be used for academic purposes, not commercial purposes, as well as the fact that the Facebook, now notorious Friends API, allowed a company to not only take the data of the person that consented, but everybody else in their network. Now, there's no legal structure anywhere in the world where I'm allowed to consent on behalf of another able-minded adult. And that is a huge problem that Facebook really still hasn't been able to solve.
When did you realize that that was happening? Because that's the really dark side of all this, is it not?
It absolutely is. Because although Facebook has closed that loophole, that data is out there. That data, which is possibly of hundreds of millions of people to billions of people, has been bought and sold and traded around the world for the past many years, and there's no way that we can actually get it back.
And that's thanks to you and Cambridge Analytica.
Well, it actually happened way before I joined the company. So a lot of this I found out in the press because it wasn't even something that was being undertaken while I was there. This was.
But you must have heard Alexander Nix. Did you not hear Alexander Nix, you know, telling people how much data he had? Did you not think, how on earth could he acquire that much data by legal means?
Well, I knew that at the time there were over 40,000 developers that were on Facebook, and that the more money that you spent on Facebook sending out quizzes like, what's your favorite Disney princess, or what country should you really be living in, or even playing Candy Crush or Farmville, that the amount of people that played that was actually gigantic. I used to watch my mom, my grandparents playing that all of the time, and everybody that that touched, their data got sent to the developer. So it was actually very easy to access this Facebook data, and I thought, well, they're spending a lot of money buying data from everyone that they can get their hands on it, so this must be one of those ways. It must be quite common. So it was a large awakening process as I started to find out the different levels of coercion that were involved and the possibility that Facebook was not obeying by their contractual means or even under consumer protection standards.
Given that Cambridge Analytica was funded, openly funded, by the billionaire Robert Mercer, who was openly a supporter of Donald Trump, what made you feel okay about working for that outfit?
So in the beginning, I knew very little about Bob Mercer, except for the fact that he was considered one of the world's best data scientists. He started his career building some of the first language learning algorithms for IBM that allowed computers to read human speech, and then took his knowledge of algorithms and applied it to the stock market for the first time, and therefore built the world's most successful data-driven hedge fund, and also the first data-driven hedge fund. So I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to learn from a data science company, might as well learn from the best. But unfortunately, the more I learned about him, the more I was not just skeptical of my decision to be working under his investment, but also very curious as to what his actual means to the ends were going to look like. In the beginning, he wasn't actually even a supporter of Donald Trump. It was rather Ted Cruz, someone who I thought would never have a chance of holding that high of political office. I guess I also thought that of Donald Trump as well.
Well, both you and Alexander Nix, interestingly enough, because you say that Nix explained, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, explained to you that the idea of Trump becoming the president of the United States was ludicrous. He said the American people would never stand for it.
Exactly.
But the real thing was trying to solidify the audience for the greatest multimedia empire in the world. That was the plan.
Exactly. That was the plan. That's what I was told. So
you were all right with that. You were all right with that plan, though.
Well, I thought it would be interesting to see a rival to Fox News at the time, and I really thought, you know, building a new TV network, you know, that's got to be pretty harmless, right?
Your first project, I think, as written about by the journalist Carol Cadwallader's expose, was trying to influence the Nigerian presidential election in 2015. Am I right?
Yes, that was the first election that I worked on when I joined the company, or rather, not worked on, but won the contract for.
And the suggestion is that you deployed Israeli hackers to influence the election. Did you do
that?
Yeah,
I wish Carol did a little bit more research or would actually speak to me before she prints things about me. But
she did give you the right of reply, I think, Brittany, did she not?
No, she actually wrote to my lawyer around midnight and printed that article at 8 in the morning. So he wasn't able to talk to me before it went to print. So
and if you had been spoken to, what would you have said?
I would have said that I introduced many people to the clients that we had because there was about a 3-week period of time before the election. So it ended up we couldn't actually run an election campaign. We were going to send people there to do what are called crisis comms, so as much communications as you can push out at a time. And there were different groups of people, not just the Israelis, that said that they could come on and help make things go faster. And so they were some of the people that we introduced.
What do you mean, make things go faster?
So they said that they had not only worked in Nigeria before, but many other African countries where Cambridge Analytica didn't have as much experience at the time. And they said they had ways of obtaining strategic information. And when they actually came back from Nigeria, they showed me a video that they had hired people to join the opposing campaign and actually participate in meetings from the other campaign and bring that back in order to use that. So it's not great. It's not something I'm either proud of or something that I would ever get involved with again. But it's definitely not what Carol makes it out to be.
Who was your client then in Nigeria?
It was a group of oil billionaires who were very afraid that if Goodluck Jonathan did not remain president of Nigeria, that their families' lives would be threatened because they had such a close relationship. And the president, the current president, Muhammadu Buhari, had a history of engaging in violence with his political rivals. So they came to us to see if there was anything that Cambridge Analytica, or I suppose the SCL group, could do in order to support Goodluck Jonathan's re-election.
I'm talking to Brittany Kaiser. You might have seen her in the documentary The Great Hack. She's now written what she calls My Inside Story of Cambridge Analytica and How Trump, Brexit and Facebook Broke Democracy. It's called Targeted. See, I read your book and it persuades me that this happened and then that happened and, oh, yes, that happened because that happened and it all seems perfectly reasonable. But then I think, hang on, here you are. You are a Democrat. You have a history of working for campaigns like the Obama campaign. You worked for Amnesty International. And you join a company who's trying to influence the Nigerian election by means of mysterious Israelis and Nigerian oil billionaires. What happens?
So I actually joined Cambridge Analytica when I was writing my PhD. I was in my third year writing on preventive diplomacy. And I got into my third chapter and it ended up being all about how you could use big data to predict atrocity crimes before they would happen, so that presidents, prime ministers, ambassadors would be able to stop wars before any violence actually occurred. No one at my law school could teach me about data, so I joined this data company to learn about advanced analytics. I really thought it was going to be a great opportunity to learn how to use tools for social impact. And because I had worked in elections before, I not only worked in the social and defense division, but also on the election side when I first got there. And unfortunately, I learned a lot more about data than I bargained for.
It took you a while to realize that what you were doing was pretty sinister and dark.
Yeah, and I couldn't regret that more.
At what point did you realize it? I mean, you say that you realized it actually on the night of Trump's election.
I would say I realized it more a couple of weeks later when my colleagues who actually ran the Trump campaign gave me a 2-day-long presentation about what they had done. And they showed us some of the most horrific things I had ever seen.
Like?
They showed us that they had created target groups called deterrents, which meant that these were people who were definitely Hillary supporters and they would never vote for Trump. So instead of encouraging these people to register to vote and to come out to rallies and to go to the polls, instead they were suppressing these people's vote. And I had never seen that before. That was the first time I was shown strategies that they use to weaponize racism and sexism, to make people hate their neighbor, to make people not believe in their government.
How long after you saw that video did you blow the whistle?
Well, I left the country a couple of weeks later in order to try to find good ways of using data. I wasn't in a financial place where I could have left or done anything. I wouldn't have been able to get lawyers. I wouldn't have been able to even pay my rent or feed myself if I would have left at that time. So I left the country, and it took another year for me to finally leave and blow the whistle.
Because it has been suggested that you didn't blow the whistle until your name was out there, thanks to Carol Cadwalader.
She would love to believe that she was responsible for that. but no, my name was already out there. I was speaking on behalf of Cambridge Analytica all around the world. People very openly knew.
But they didn't know the details.
I was on panels, I was on TV, I was talking to press.
They didn't know the details of what you'd done. But as soon as the details...
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
And as soon as the details of what you'd done started emerging, pretty much the very next day, you blew the whistle.
No, it was actually after Chris Wiley came out, and that was the first time that I found out that the Facebook data had been taken, perhaps illegally or at least very unethically. And some more things that he started to say rang bells. And I got into my computer. I realized I still had access to all of my documents. I had quit the company a couple months before. And I saw quite a few more things that I thought, hey, the world definitely needs to know about this. Chris Wiley wasn't at Cambridge Analytica during Brexit or Trump. So if things are going to come out, now's the time to actually go out and tell people what actually happened. So I've been working for many days already with The Guardian in San Francisco at their bureau there in order to actually figure out what I knew, what the public should figure out, what I had evidence for. And all of my work actually came out right after that article, but I had already started the process.
As you say, Chris Wiley was the first whistleblower about a week before you, I think.
Exactly, yeah.
How do you feel about him? He suggested that you were disgruntled, you'd fallen out with Alexander Nix, you didn't get the promotion you wanted, and that was, in large part, the motivation for you blowing the whistle.
No, I had already quit the company and was moving on to do something else with my life. You know, he was a lot more disgruntled than me. He was actually in a legal battle and had to shut down his own data company because of Alexander suing him for contravening his NDAs. So actually, I've never met Chris Wiley, so I'm not sure what his problem is with me. But he wasn't at the company when Brexit or the Trump campaign happened. So although I'm very happy that he came out and did what he did, it definitely gave me a motivation to do the right thing myself. My question is, if he wanted to talk more about what happened with Cambridge Analytica and Brexit and Trump, then he shouldn't have claimed that information as his own or as primary source material. It's one of the main reasons I felt like I needed to come out, because a lot of the articles I was seeing were just not accurate because he didn't have firsthand information. So I wanted to go out there and add to what he had already said and say, okay, what he said is incredibly important. And here's the rest of it, because there's a lot more to the story. And it's so important that people understand all of this.
So did Cambridge Analytica work for UKIP's Aaron Banks and the Leave EU campaign he funded?
Yes, they did. Definitely. I was a part of that. And so the main confusion that has come out is whether or not we ran the entire campaign, and Cambridge Analytica did not run the entire campaign. Cambridge started by working with UKIP in order to get their data, not just the data from their members, but surveys that they had undertaken on why people did or did not want to leave the European Union, in order to make models, so to find those psychographic groups of people who did want to leave and develop messaging for them. So that piece of work was done on behalf of UKIP, and the plan was that UKIP would give that to Leave EU for use, and Cambridge would be a part of the next campaign. But he never paid an invoice, and so Cambridge stopped doing any further work after that.
People who watch the documentary, The Great Hack, will remember that you were hiding out, it seemed, in Thailand. There was a lot of packing and moving, and you seemed to be, yeah, in hiding. What were you in hiding from?
So I think it's really important to recognize that Chris Wiley and I have been incredibly lucky. Most whistleblowers not only can never get a job again, but they get persecuted. They get threatened with physical violence. So do their families sometimes. And a lot of them even lose their freedom. So when you say that the Brexit campaign and the Trump campaign were possibly conducted illegally, you're definitely at risk from quite a few people, especially when that implicates powerful companies like Facebook. So I had no idea what the U.S. government was going to say, what the British government was going to say, or what any other private sector actors were going to do or threaten. So I thought, let's go somewhere and see what everyone's reactions are and then plan accordingly to see if I can come back. I was just lucky I was invited by both the British government and the U.S. government in order to come and help.
And was your family threatened?
My family have been through a lot. They have received a lot of hate. They've lost personal friends. And, you know, I really think that I'm just lucky to have them by my side and have them stand by me through those harder times. But that was when the story first came out. A lot of people were confused about what had happened. They weren't really well informed. And over the past year and a half, it's been a process of educating the public, educating governments and legislators and investigators. And now that there's a big movement for change that I have been a big part of, not only for legislation and regulation, but public awareness and digital literacy, I now have mostly supporters all around the world, millions of them, who are excited about the Own Your Data movement and about making an impact so that we might actually have privacy in the future.
Just as a matter of interest, why did you go and meet Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy?
Well, the number one reason is because I was invited. I don't know many people that would say no to an invitation like that.
But why were you invited?
We had a mutual friend who had recently passed away. For his family's privacy, they've asked me to please stop mentioning his name in the press. So I would appreciate that, too. But we were there mourning together. And, you know, it was an opportunity to actually get to sit down with somebody that I had been writing about in my studies since I was a teenager.
And had you funneled money to WikiLeaks?
Funneling is quite a strong word.
It's a good word.
it's a strong word when I send a couple hundred dollars to him when I was a poor law student writing about whistleblowers in war crime situations. That was my expertise at university. So the Iraq war files that WikiLeaks had dropped when I was studying my master's were absolutely essential to the work that I was doing to describe why the U.S. government should be held accountable for war crimes.
Do you feel as if you have had to rehabilitate yourself to yourself or in the eyes of the world?
More to myself, trying to do a deep dive and figure out how I got myself into that situation, how I let myself be so manipulated, and how I mean,
were you manipulated?
I consider myself a very smart person, but as I was writing my book, especially going back and tracing every single step, I wonder, was I motivated to try to financially support myself and my family, or was I motivated by power? I don't know, but something seduced me. Something manipulated me, not just Alexander Nix, the whole concept of it. And I got led astray. So to try to figure that out and admit to myself that I was wrong and that I not only have something to atone for internally, but to explain to the public that I'm here to right a wrong and I'm here to only do positive in the future has been quite an emotional journey, to say the least.
Just let me get back to the point I tried to make earlier, really. You were a worldly person, a very highly connected person, a sophisticated woman. How is it that you were manipulated?
I suppose I had never really seen behind the curtain of the way that power brokering really works. My first venture into that was writing a PhD on diplomacy, to try to figure out how backdoor negotiations actually happen. How do powerful people make their decisions and how do they exert influence on people? I guess I found out quite a lot about that and I assumed too much. I assumed that maybe that this is the way that a lot of people do things and that this isn't just a special case of a company that's crossing the line. I couldn't have been more wrong.
Is that manipulation or is that just dropping your moral compass?
I suppose you can look at it whichever way you want, but I definitely think that the way that I was treated by Alexander was a little bit more than manipulative.
In what way?
Constantly promising me that I would be able to just work on projects that were important to me. Constantly telling me I'd be able to earn enough money to support myself and my family for the rest of my life, constantly dangling these carrots to keep me there. And I didn't have any choice. I had no safety net. So I just kept on running after the carrot until it just became too much.
If he had been a nicer person, would you have blown the whistle at all?
Well, I mean, you're not the first person to ask me that. It's something that I've done a lot of reflection on, and I wonder, would it have sparked it at that time? And, you know, I'm grateful it eventually did spark it and that he wasn't nicer to me, because this has actually been incredibly helpful for public awareness and the advancement of privacy as a concept in this world.
Where is he now? Do you know?
I've been told by many people that he's still in London as a political consultant, probably doing exactly what he was doing before, just with less staff members.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you quote a proposal that he'd done for blockchain, which read that Cambridge Analytica passionately believes that consumer data belongs to the consumer and wants to develop a mechanism to give back control to the individual. That sounds ironic.
It certainly does. But I was the one that pushed all of that forward. I was the one that begged him to create a blockchain department because it was the way that we were going to solve a lot of the murky problems of the data industry. That's really why he got me to stay an extra year after the Trump election, which is when I wanted to run screaming for the hills. But I said, if I can start working on projects that I care about, that are ethical, that are going to make a good impact in the world, then I'll stick around a little bit longer until at least I told myself I'd stick around until I had enough money to get out of there.
One of the things that you're pushing for with the Digital Asset Trade Association is to get political ads on Facebook banned. Do you think that that will happen?
So I suppose, to explain that a little bit further, it's not that I want them banned forever. It's that right now I know that Facebook nor Google nor Twitter have the manpower nor the technology ready in order to police disinformation or discrimination, racism, sexism. They're not good enough at it yet. So if they're going to decide to let politicians say whatever they want, I think citizens are incredibly at risk, especially in election years. So to make the decision that Jack Dorsey just did to say, we're going to pause on this because there's no way that we could possibly make sure that people are treated ethically, then that's a great temporary solution while they invest the real money to solve the problems properly.
And what else do you want to achieve with your Digital Asset Trade Association?
We've been working a lot on privacy legislation. I specifically have been working with the state of New York alongside Professor David Carroll, who is in the Great Hack documentary with me, to help them close all of the loopholes, even loopholes from GDPR and CCPA. I've also been working in California to help promote the new privacy legislation there. Some of it is going into enactment in January, so that's quite soon, but they've already put forth amendments to it that are going to go to vote. If New York and California decide to take on privacy legislation, then we have a real shot at getting that introduced federally.
You've explained that you first went to Cambridge Analytica because you were seduced by the glamour and the money and the power. Are you still seducible by all those things?
No. I run two nonprofits and I don't have a salary. The only money that I've earned recently was writing a book, which was great. But otherwise, all of my work is pro bono so far. I'm hoping that I can start to raise donations for some of the lobbying work I'm doing and some of the digital literacy work I'm doing to teach kids how to protect themselves online in public schools in America. But for right now, that's all funded by what little I have in my bank account. So, you know, being well known around the world doesn't actually equal having those types of finances. So I've gone back to my old ways of the traditional human rights activist being scrappy. But it's working. I'm really happy that I'm back to my old self.
Again, your not best friend, Carol Cadwallader, has said that she doesn't think very much of you monetizing and exploiting your role. And she may have a point. I mean, you were on the side of Satan with Cambridge Analytica, and now you say you're on the side of the angels and you are capitalizing on what you've done, aren't you?
I wish I could say that that's what it was. I didn't get paid or work for anyone for quite a while after becoming a whistleblower. It's a job to write a book. I haven't really monetized very much at all since I left. Unfortunately, Carol's quite sexist, and she doesn't say that about Chris Wiley, who sold his rights for millions of dollars to a cartoon company and now works for H&M, selling factory clothes to people using data. So he's not an activist. He came out as a whistleblower and then monetized everything that he did. Unfortunately, that's not great, but she'll never say a thing or two about that because he's her whistleblower. It's quite sad that she's so bitter.
And that was Brittany Kaiser, whose book is called Targeted, the Cambridge Analytica Whistleblower's Inside Story of How Big Data, Trump and Facebook Broke Democracy and How It Can Happen Again, is the full title.